Hello, this is Arlen Bankston, and you're listening to the Agile Uprising Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of the Agile Uprising Podcast. I'm Brad Stokes, and today we're joined by Arlen Bankston. Arlen.
Hello, Brad.
How about you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Certainly. So I'm based in the United States outside of Washington, D.C. I'm an owner of an agile consulting company called Lithespeed. That's L-I-T-H-E for those listening. And effectively, I've just finished a book called HR and the Agile Organization. So we're going to be talking a little bit about that subject. Briefly speaking, my background, I've been about 20 years in the agile field now. Started out as a user experience designer and got into the field in the early days of extreme programming, largely talking about how to blend a lot of those practices in XP with some of these ideas from interaction design and user experience design, usability, and so on. And I have actually now been an executive in an organization for 11 years. So a lot of what I'll be speaking about here, I've applied both at client sites and actually to our own company. A lot of what you'll be hearing is, to some degree, we've tried it on ourselves first before we go out and torture our clients with it.
Cool. Now, you're using Agile and HR today, or Agile and People Ops, and there are a couple of different facets to this. There's the support facet as well as the using HR within an Agile way. How about we kick off and let's look at the role of HR, the role of People Ops in Agile. Where do you see that going?
Well, I see really quite an expansion of the position. If you look at HR historically, the analogy that came to mind just today, really, but it seems appropriate enough, they're moving from being something akin to policemen to something perhaps a little closer to cruise directors. And what I mean by that is, historically, human resources has been, of course, largely a compliance function, looking to weed out the liabilities in an organization, control kind of legal events that you'd rather not see, and so on. And as such, they've been, to some degree, kind of leading from behind in a certain way, setting the culture of organizations. But often they're not the people you'd want to get a call from, right? It's you don't say, "I've got a call coming in from HR. I can't wait to take this," right? So I think really what you're seeing is in an increasingly competitive market and an increasingly chaotic world, you've got a movement towards this idea of more people operations, which is, as the name implies, a little more people focused, a little more about trying to set up an environment where people can function effectively with the understanding that work isn't quite so straightforward as it used to be. For instance, job titles, right? If you look at an agile team, there's a lot of talk of T-shaped resources and versatilists and generalizing specialists and the like. This notion that we, are capable of doing more than just one thing, and that over time we expect people to be facile in a number of different disciplines, really, and to pick up skills from one another and to be able to more fluidly hand off work from one person to the next with, better understanding of things like nearest neighbor functions. So given all that, that means that we've got, a lot more dynamic career progressions. You've got situations like people staying at companies a lot shorter periods of time than they used to, and fundamentally a struggle for talent and for trying to get the best people. And I think, if you just look at Agile specifically as a delivery discipline for a moment here, it's of course getting increasingly difficult to find really and truly good, experienced Agile people. And I mean that in every respect, from developers who are very strong Agile engineers, can set up, DevOps pipelines and all that nice stuff, over to roles like the product owner, which, has of course been around for a long time under Scrum, but you look around and you say, how many good product owners are out there in the world? And most of them suck, So I think really it's coming down to a lot of that of you've got a really challenging situation and getting organizations that are actually good at this stuff. And of course, it has a lot to do with people and maybe the lack of support for their progression and understanding of, all the things they really need to make it work.
So where do you see HR, for instance, in the job role? You mentioned job role titles.
Yeah.
How do you see that happens? Because like you said, there's a slight blurring of the lines. We still need testers. We still need devs. We still need our people that specialize in looking at product and their life cycle and all that sort of thing. How do you see HR transforming in that respect? Because it becomes a little bit blurry around the edges. I know from just a development perspective, I'm too a UI UX guy, watching people put still jQuery on things, still used out there, but you know, it's not our primary focus, but it's still on all the job titles. And that's just dev. When you talk about Scrum Master, I've seen some very interesting descriptions.
Oh, yeah.
How do you see HR actually getting to understand the even nature of the roles?
Yeah, I think it has a lot to do perhaps with with local knowledge. So I think if you look around, there's a lot more variegation than there used to be. You've got, you know, even from one Agile team to the next, you certainly see different dynamics at play, right? Different connections between specific people, different, you know, complementary skill sets needed. And as such, you're really looking at a place where people can go in, you know, a lot more different directions than they used to. So it begs the question of, do roles, do they really need to be defined uniformly across an entire organization? Or could you allow for some differentiation from group to group? I mean, I'll throw out something like the product owner, actually. Just one of my pet peeves here. Being a product owner, trainer, and all that, I run into quite a lot of anti-patterns here. I think what you're expecting from someone like a product owner really is that they understand enough to make good value judgments. And if you look in some places, this might mean that they're, let's say, a domain expert. It's commonly the way the role is cast, is someone who really understands the thing that's to be built and therefore will naturally make the best decisions. But actually, there are extremely effective product owners in many circumstances that are not domain experts, that actually are rather essentially very good analysts, problem solvers, and you know, value proposition sort of comprehenders, if you will. And they're able to jump into just about any situation, see the players, gain empathy with the need of the end customers, and find the right choice. So I think if I were going into somewhere where you had a product owner over, say, a scientific research team that's going into a very deep subject around, you know, pick quantum mechanics or something esoteric of that nature, you know, you probably are going to want someone who actually is an expert because of the nature of the knowledge and the depth that's needed there. But in many actually, you know, new product development efforts, business process redesign efforts, things of that nature, you'd actually almost rather somebody who is simply more capable at gaining the ear of stakeholders, at making compelling kind of arguments for why one thing should be chosen over another, sort of transparent prioritization schemes and things of that nature. So I think, you know, if you just go and you read the book descriptions and say, all right, across the board, here's what an agile person looks like, you'll certainly find patterns, and those will tend to be pretty consistent. But I think, you know, to put it bluntly, an HR person to be most effective would really need to be down there in the trenches with a given team and be able to see who are the people, how do they fit together, how well are they actually functioning, and, you know, given all of that, what do I need to do to raise their performance, both to perform better in the team, but also, and I'll throw this out as, you know, a person who was in Agile teams for a long time myself prior to, you know, getting out and coaching them and becoming a consultant all the time. You know, I, as a UX practitioner, and perhaps this will resonate with you, I learned a lot of other disciplines in Agile teams by working with developers and testers and so on. What I did not learn was much more about how to become a good UX practitioner, though, right? So if you look at being embedded in an Agile team, especially over the long term, you can, to some degree, lose the connection with your own discipline. And so being able to actually go and, say, pull UX people together across teams, make sure they're getting the support they needed at that discipline level, you know, that's something that perhaps Scrum Masters and product owners and so on, they're not really going to be necessarily paying attention to or even able to see. But I think that that's where, you know, kind of learning and development groups within HR functions, let's say, can highlight it and say, hey, look, we've got a discipline here where we need to bring these people together across teams and have them, you know, share skill sets with one another and cross-pollinate.
So share communities of practice along those sort of lines, establish
abilities. Guilds and, yeah, all that sort of thing.
Awesome. Now, we're talking about the talent side of things, the people coming into a team. How does HR, like, I know HR is obviously the person that signs all the dotted lines. How do they go about finding somebody that fits with the given team. So we're talking a big picture. You've got this idea where it's not just cookie cutter design for a given Scrum team. That's great. Or any other style of agile team that you want. But then if you're putting somebody into that role, how do you find somebody that actually fits? Because there's so much out there, even on just looking at developers. I've gone through the ringer personally for development jobs where I've taken 15 million tests and all the bits. That doesn't necessarily mean I'm a good fit for the team.
Yeah, I think, you know, some of the most effective approaches I've seen have been, to some degree, try before you buy sort of situations where you have policies of allowing people to actually come in and audit new teams, for instance. And this, of course, would only make sense when you've got someone already in the organization and they're moving, say, laterally from one team to the next. When hiring in, though, you'll actually see similar types of approaches used on occasion. You know, I actually hearken back to, and then this is a, you know, a bit of an older thought at the moment, but there was something called the Hungry Academy out at Living Social, if you recall these guys. They were a local company out here, and one of the problems they had was acquiring Ruby talent. They had sucked up all the good Ruby developers in the area long since, and there just really weren't any more about. So they decided they needed to grow their own. And what they did basically was set up a training program. It was open to the public. You could apply to it. There was a limited set of spots. It wasn't a huge thing. I believe it was something in the order of 100 or so people would get in. And basically, you would have to pay a little bit to get into this program, and they would basically embed you in a team and help you learn Ruby, right? So a lot of folks wanted to get in just, you know, to learn Ruby. But at the end of this period, I believe it was about 6 weeks or so, this whole program, they would basically either offer you a job at Living Social or they wouldn't, right? And what this allowed them to do was, A, get talent, because everybody wanted to get in there, frankly, whether they got hired or not, just to gain the skills, since Ruby training was kind of few and far between. But also, of course, it allowed them to sort of weed people out and get some experience with them as they went through the program, so that by the end, they had a nice little set to choose among. I find that sort of thing particularly interesting. You know, looking at perhaps more established approaches, I've seen a whole host of interview games and sort of exercises being applied, in order to try to find people who fit better. I think some combination of discovering basically whether other people on the team view you as competent and whether you have some sort of a shared value system is a nice kind of place to start. So if you look in a lot of the studies out there of performance management and of hiring have shown that things like basically general acuity, general smarts is a very good indicator whether someone's going to perform well. You know, you combine that with some ideas of talking through scenarios and, kind of not really puzzles as such, but really walking through more, work-based scenarios. What would you do in this kind of situation? HBR case study style stuff. Then you can get a good sense of how people actually think. And whether that therefore they're going to be effective in their role in the team, and also to some degree whether they're going to align personality-wise with some of the players. But I think at the end of the day, looking strategically, I would always want to be able to experiment and allow people some mobility, and also allow to some degree the team to have a voice in it. Right? You hear about things like voting people off the island and all that sort of thing. That's one approach, but I think at the end of the day, the gist of it is that teams have to have some voice in whether people, come or stay with them, or they're not really going to feel like a team at the end of the day.
So we've gone down that rabbit hole. You've brought somebody in. You thought that they were going to be a good fit. They're not quite working. What do you think happens next?
Yeah, I mean, of course, what you'd like to do is start with transparency, right? I mean, I think as a general philosophy here, we'd really try to start moving a little bit more in that direction of, allowing people to raise issues, and specifically, I'd say, other team members. A lot of what people call self-management in Agile circles really actually is a bit more like peer management, right? I mean, people do a good job because what they do is open, and because they don't really like being glared at by their colleagues all the time and by slacking off. So they tend to just step up, right? That makes them feel better and so on. So I think a lot of these tactics of, kind of bringing these issues to the fore quickly, hitting them straight on, not trying to hide them, I think that could be useful in the near term. You know, and then the voting off the island thing, I remember actually at a client I was at for a while, they basically had that policy in place, but it was rarely actually employed, and people would often leave of their own accord, right? So you would have to get a 2/3 vote of confidence every quarter to stay in the teams in this company. But again, most people just kind of left before the axe ever fell because they knew it was coming. So, I mean, it's to some degree, this radical transparency can help these problems take care of themselves. But all that being said, let's just zip to the end of the line. These people just ain't working. Well, in that case, I think the key is that you can't allow things to drag on for too long. And I'll just say from personal experience here, I have, you know, sadly fired a number of people in my time at this point, and it's always a really hard thing to do, right? It's I guess I consider myself a little bit of a softy, and it's especially just emotionally painful to do it, right? You always try to hold off as long as possible and look for every possible remedy, but you know, the longer you wait, the more it drags on, the worse things get. And it's, you know, and I think that's the case for everyone, including the person who's eventually going to be let go. So I look at, actually, there's a local company here called The Motley Fool, a very well-known kind of financial services investment advice company. And they've, you know, been clients of ours in the past and longtime friends of ours out here in the area. And they've done a lot of interesting things, actually, in the people operations space. This being one of them, actually, they found this to be a problem among their managers, that people were quite hesitant to let people go, right? And they would hem and haw over it, and they'd really avoid it for much longer than they should. So what they did was they solved that problem by making it very easy to let people go. And what it amounted to was really a very generous severance package, right? So it's, I believe that's for every year you're at the company, you get, I believe it's a month or a couple of months of your annual salary when they let you go, right? So it's a pretty generous severance package here. And what it means is, when managers get to that point, it's pretty easy for them, right? I mean, frankly, the employees even thank them sometimes, because if it's not working out, it's not working out. And as long as you're able to leave a job, you know, to some degree on a high note, where you've got enough to sustain you for, say, a few months, you can get out of the market and find something else. It's not necessarily a bad thing, right? It's, if you're in a place where you're not performing well, it's not good for you either. So I think that, you know, finding a way to basically make the termination process itself a little more humane is a big part of it.
Well, we've talked about the termination side of things, which is never pleasant. When we've got somebody coming on, say brand new into the team, how does HR support that process? So they've gone through the hiring process. How do I bring them on into a team?
You know, there are a lot of interesting onboarding techniques I've been seeing lately. Actually, since I was just talking about, I'll throw out one more little nugget about the Motley Fool here. When they start new people in their company, one of the things they try to do is take a lot of the drudgery out of it. And what I mean by that is they get a lot of the paperwork out of the way right up front. And that's nice, right? You come in on a Friday morning, all the paperwork's out of the way in the morning, and then you take a snack cart around the office, and you give everybody in the company something to eat, right? So this is interesting because, of course, you're getting to meet everybody, and the fact that you're giving them food means that they're probably happy to see you. And, you know, they've also been apprised of your coming, and they've often got little counter gifts ready to hand you on the way back. So it's, you know, it's kind of opens it up with a bit of a human vibe. And I think, you know, that's a good thing to do, is get people to really know one another. You know, a lot of jobs can be a little bit mechanistic, and this includes in agile teams for sure, right? It's, you know, I think I've seen, for better or worse, well, for worse in my mind, actually, quite pointedly, there's been a real mechanization of agile environments where, you know, it becomes all about the velocity and the estimation and blah, 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 right? It's a lot of these sort of aspects of it that are really relatively trivial or even training wheels are harmful in the long term. So I think, you know, making sure that you're paying attention to make sure these people understand one another, specifically things like motivations. So there are, I've occasionally used a motivation game from Jorgen Apollo, actually, the Management 3.0 author has been out there. He's got a number of games around these notions, but around looking at motivating factors, right? These often matched up from folks like Dan Pink and Dan Ariely and other such behavioral economists and motivational authors. So, you know, I think something like that can be nice. And actually also simulating a lot of the, the systems, the tools. There's a colleague of mine named Jesse Sternschuss. She's works in, but basically runs a company called The Improv Effect and uses a lot of those techniques to teach people how to work together better, basically. She designed a number of onboarding games for some of the clients that she worked with, actually interactive exercises to help them get up to speed with simple things like how to run the project management tools, email, and so on and so forth. So just trying to make it fun and a little bit more of a pull system of getting out there and figuring out things as they go along.
Now let's cast this forward 3 months. We're still looking at supporting teams. Mm-hmm. You were saying that it's best to get feedback early often, much the same way that we run, say, our scrums. We want something coming back at us so we can make changes. So we're 3 months in. How does HR then facilitate that ongoing communication about destination and how people are traveling?
Yeah, so I think basically it comes down to having development conversations with people, right? So it's this is something that you hear about in HR a lot, that the HR folks actually talk to people. But in all my jobs, I've rarely really seen that happen with any frequency. It's, you don't just go in and hang out with the HR person and have a chat about your career, in any sort of a regular basis. It's a rare event, like right up when you start, you chat with them maybe. And when things go real wrong, you might chat with them. And that's about it, right? Maybe annual performance reviews. But here, what we're talking about is having the opportunity to speak much more often and really lay out aspirations. And I think, this isn't something I was personally involved in, but I was reading about a rejiggering of the management system, performance management system at Deloitte, the big consultancy. And one thing they did was moved to actually weekly conversations. That I'll be honest and say that's the most intense I've heard of yet, but weekly conversations between HR people and the folks that they're mentoring. And part of the idea here is, and I think it's a rich one, and in the HR functions I've seen that have worked the best, it's certainly been a true facet. They're a little more forward thinking than they are rear view mirror. And what I mean is, if you're talking to somebody weekly or even monthly, you actually can talk about what's happening then and there, right? You can talk about their personal challenges. You can talk about what they're hoping to do next. And you can get out in front of things, right? I regard it almost as the similar to the shift you've seen in agile testers versus kind of the more traditional aspects of the role, that agile testers really try to prevent mistakes from ever arising, by doing things like putting tests in place. If you think about HR and something of a similar facet, instead of trying to fix problems after they've happened, they're really trying to head them off the pass, right? And I think if they're down there in the trenches, they have a much more, it's much more likely that they'll actually be able to manage that.
It sounds like the conversation is moving, it's actually moving from an interview to a conversation and continuing the conversation.
That's right. Most of the organizations that I've worked with so far, it kind of comes down to a common pattern. And it's the balance between, capability and desire, right? So it's kind of looking and, you hear about empowerment quite a bit in agile circles as well. And what does that really mean? Well, it's really the combination of those things, right? You can actually make a decision on something and you're interested in making a decision on that something. But more importantly, you have the skills and the knowledge and the capabilities to make good decisions. And I think right there, this points to one of the, perhaps deeply underserved functions of HR in a lot of companies, which is learning and development. If we really want to say that we'd like to upskill people, it can become pretty obvious what they need to know if you're, there with them on a regular basis and you're able to see where they've succeeded, where they failed, where their interests lie. So, I kind of look there and say that you really like to be able to say, what do people want to do? Let's try to allow them to explore those areas and let's try to make sure that learning resources are available to make sure that when they do land, they've got the support they need to be successful.
Nice. Now, we're also talking about communication intra-team. Say there's a conflict, because conflicts happen all the time. Some organizations, it's, there's a conflict, we call in HR. Obviously, that's not the best pattern.
Mm-hmm.
When does HR come into play? Say I've got a Scrum team, there's something going on there. It's fairly visible from the outside that there's dysfunction of some variety. When does HR start the conversation with the team?
Well, it's, you know, you could almost think of this in a couple of different ways. I would think that actually having HR, depending on how you've set up the function, you know, a lot of companies, it's still a fairly centralized function, but in some, they've begun to actually decentralize it and move HR out into specific organizational departments and even actually into specific teams. If you're in that latter situation, then you can imagine the HR person can get involved pretty early. If you're still more centralized, I would view it as perhaps a latter stage thing, but let me hit the problem from a different angle. The way I see it is that what you're really talking about is coaching here, right? Of being able to get in there and help people to work out their differences, conflict management. How do we understand how to deal with these situations? And actually at a local level, that's something you'd hope that folks like Scrum Masters would be good at, right? And would be able to do. It's also something that you'd hope folks like, say, you know, so-called chapter managers or functional managers, development managers, you'd hope it'd be something that they would be good at doing as well. So I think, you know, in many cases, pushing these skills of coaching down to the appropriate parties and making sure that they're able to do it for, you know, at least the lower level sorts of situations until it gets to a certain point, you know, in my mind, that would actually be ideal because you don't want to really have to go outside of the team unless it's really, you know, really getting bad and toxic, or unless perhaps the, you know, the person who's in that lower level coaching role isn't really capable of fulfilling their function properly.
So we've talked about conflict within the team. We've talked about some good behaviors on how agile can HR teams can support an agile team. How do you get the HR team to that point?
So, you know, common wisdom to this point has said that the you know, HR groups can and should perhaps use agile methods themselves to some degree. I'd say, to me, it's very useful if you're going to be leading an organization that does something regularly. And the way a lot of companies are moving, this agile thing is not—it's not just a team-level construct anymore, right? When we hear about the agile organization, this is a whole other set of things that are happening here. These are complete organizational redesigns and realignments in many cases. So, you know, moving into things like having long-standing experience teams, having, you know, value streams in the organization, and aligning you know, functional skill sets within those rather than into silo departments. You know, all of these things are indicative of a shift that means that we really need to have HR people take a much broader understanding than they have previously. So I think that at one level, being familiar with a lot of these new organizational design patterns is pretty important because, you know, it begins to point to how HR is going to intersect with any of these groups. And I mean things like, you know, if you look in Frederic Laloux's book, Reinventing Organizations, he lays out the notion of a teal company, right, which is quite self-managing. If you're going for anything like that, you're talking about a very different, you know, much more localized decision-making, much different sorts of structures of the company than you would have in a more traditional hierarchical organization. So I think there's that.
Is it possible to actually move an organization like that? There's some argument out there that Salesforce is known for having a very open structure where anybody can look at anything. But even the founders have come out and said a few times, well, we're pretty much stuck the shape that we've currently got. We've developed it around this, and to reform the cultures and everything, we'd more or less have to start the business from the ground. Is it possible to move from that older style of management where you've got a centralized HR function out into something very different? Because you're talking about a big change management piece happening right there.
No doubt.
How difficult is that?
Well, it depends on the size, right? Is it possible? Sure it is, right? It's definitely happened in a number of companies. One of our clients at the moment is Nationwide Insurance. We worked with them for a long time on the IT side, more recently also on the business side. And they're undergoing, in one of their digital groups, are undergoing a significant restructuring to move into kind of this experienced team structure that I mentioned. You know, fundamentally, as with any sort of change like that, they're starting somewhat small and within a given division. And, you know, were that to work, they're going to expand it out to other areas. But I think it's, it's certainly possible. I think there has to be, to some degree, a bit of a burning platform, as you know, as you need for any change here. But I think plenty of companies have that already. It's they're in a bit of an existential crisis. They're having trouble getting the right talent, right? They're having trouble keeping up with their competition, especially these large old legacy companies. You know, they're really fighting for their survival. And you know, part of their tactic is snatching up smaller companies. There's one model, right? I've seen some companies, big, you know, older organizations pull in newer, fresher, smaller, already agile companies and basically kind of sandbox them off, let them do their thing still. And then actually they've put those people in the position of helping to coach the rest of the organization on how to do that. So I've seen that happen actually numerous times across my larger clients. And it to a large degree begins to work. It takes a long time, but it works. I think if I were to have my druthers, right, and actually enter an environment where I could set this up the way I think it should work, you need executive support, right? I mean, this is nothing new for any organizational change initiative of any sort, setting Agile aside. But I think especially for this sort of thing, you're asking really for a pretty, for HR to really hit at a pretty high weight, right? I mean, for them to be probably up at the C-suite or at least very close to it. If you have that, then you can to some degree say, all right, we're going to change the culture, everyone. Here it comes, right? And then we can do it gradually. But at least that way, everybody is on the same page about where we're headed. Whereas still these days, you tend to see that you know, parts of organizations change, but that really you rarely see that kind of top-down, we're going to change the whole company kind of mandate. And, you know, at least if you have that, everybody's in the same bus instead of trying to, you know, some are trying to push the new way. Others are looking at them and saying, oh, look at the golden children and sort of, you know, looking down on them and trying to actually desperately keep the old way alive. And, you know, you end up with a bunch of infighting. So I think that trying to say we're all going the same direction, even if it'll take us a while to get there, is pretty important to make it work.
How do you move the middle? Like, I've heard from a few friends and that are out there in industry, and they say, look, the guys at the top, they want to change. They know we need to change. It's 100%. They're talking to their stakeholders, which, you know, control the dollars. The guys at the bottom are saying, we love this new agile way of working, but there's this thing in the middle. We're not getting through. I've heard it called the frozen middle.
Yeah, yeah.
How do you move the middle?
Well, you make sure they have a role to play, right? I mean, you tell them there's a... that there is a future for them.
And there is a role to play, isn't there?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you look at, I remember my first CSM I took with, you know, with Ken Schwaber way back in the day. And he opened the class by asking for a show of hands. How many of you people are project managers? And he followed it up by saying, you're all fired, right? I mean, and I just remember this as actually a number of my clients were at that session and walked away a little bit, you know, a little bit concerned about that statement, let's say, and we had to do a little bit of damage control. Basically, this, you know, that idea that we're going to make all the managers go away, it's been repeated a lot in the Agile literature. It's, you know, you hear a lot of coaches talk about it. The idea of self-management seems to imply it. So I think being able to say, hey, you know, the game plan here isn't for us to just eventually fire all of you people. So why don't you just help us implement that, right? I mean, you can see why that's not going to go anywhere. If you say, you know what we're going to do? We're going to take a lot of the drudgery out of your jobs. All this, you know, time tracking crap and all these other sorts of mundane tasks that you never like to do anyhow, we're going to automate away a lot of that. We're going to have the teams handle some of that on their own. You know, we're going to let you do the more kind of empowering work of growing people, right? We want you to find people, make them better people, make them more effective. You know, this is what good managers can do. And I think back to that experiment, if you recall that Google fired all their managers, I think it was around 2007, 2008, somewhere in there, but they fired all the managers, right? And they quickly realized it was a really bad idea and that they actually needed managers, right? And if you go and look at their rework site now, which is quite a good resource, incidentally, for HR stuff, but they talk a lot about building great managers and how actually critical the role really is, because it's, you know, I think actually in Agile circles, one of the things that gets missed a lot is the very function that HR fulfills, and it's personal development. Personal, that is me being developed, right? It's you hear a lot about the team and trust for the team and respect for the team, and I completely agree on all those points. But we often forget the individual, right? And how it's still important for people to stand out. There's this kind of a tension you're trying to balance between differentiation and integration, right? You need people to feel unique. So I think that, you know, that being able to look at that and say that, you know, we can get in and help people actually feel different, help managers to do work that's more meaningful. And, you know, I think that that can actually make it a lot easier pill to swallow for them to say that we are going to put you in a position in the future. Your job is to grow people, and it's going to be a, you know, a lot more dynamic job than it used to be. So probably a little more fun.
It's a real mindset shift, isn't it? It's that moving from not to direct, like you provide direction where needed, but it's not necessarily your job is to direct. Your job is to support and grow.
Yeah. And to clear the blockers, right? And when I say that, I'm not talking about like project level impediments. Think about what really happens in organizations that are purportedly agile. What I see? I see a few good teams in a company that on the whole is not agile. An actually agile organization can fundamentally turn on a dime, right? I mean, that's what the word means. It's about adaptability, right? It's about being able to move quickly, make smart decisions, and adapt. So, you know, given all of that, I think that you often see people focusing on the delivery side of things and forgetting the people side, right? Forgetting that it's important to, you know, to make sure that the people actually feel supported on a personal level.
So we've talked about organizational shape, how managers can support. They really do have a role for us, and how HR is central to supporting that. How do we get our HR department to that point? How do we find the right people that find the right people, that support the right people, that help the growth?
So, you know, probably one of the simplest strategies is for HR groups to get fundamentally familiar with agile methods, right? I mean, I think in most cases I've seen the HR teams that are in agile organizations do indeed adopt at least some facets of agile methods themselves. And I, you know, this of course helps them to understand them a bit better and their mechanics, values, principles, and so on, and hence hopefully better able to support them. But I see probably a simple flavor of Kanban light being used most frequently, just given its inherent flexibility. I've also seen Scrum employed quite often, and quite often a combination of those two. So you with Kanban, you've got kind of the you know, inherent value stream focus. It lets you sort of take a job as it is, lay it out, do some WIP limitation, and bring some focus, and that's nice. The Scrum thing, I think, can help to model some of the coaching behaviors that you're looking for. Help to model the ideas of kind of flow and you know, helping things to move through. Visual management, right? All of those aspects are very useful. So I see a lot of HR teams beginning to drive towards a little more cross-functional behavior themselves. That is, beginning to pull people together across functions like recruiting, payroll, and so on, performance management folks, learning and development, and to form cross-functional teams themselves. And then actually to begin to some degree, pan-skill their own people, right? That is, perhaps the recruiters might start working more closely with redesigning payroll systems and so on. So, I mean, that kind of thing is beginning to, you know, model cross-functionality as they get in there. I think that's a good place to start because it can help them to understand things. I think also going and actually working directly with a few agile teams, and I mean, perhaps just maybe dropping in on a retrospective every once in a while, right? Let the team know you're coming, but just to see what it's like, to get a flavor of the sorts of impediments that teams are encountering, the sorts of desires they have. Very often in teaching Scrum classes, a simple tip I give people about retrospectives is drop the action items you'd like to take into two buckets. There's stuff you can do yourself, there's stuff you need help with. And the fact of the matter is that everywhere I've ever been, the stuff you can do on your own is a pretty short list, actually. And there's quite a long list that falls into the second category. And it's not just affecting your team, it's affecting all of them, right? So I think in particular, HR people and managers for that matter, more generally, you know, it's that second category where teams really need help. And I think that's the stuff, actually, the issues in that category, those are the ones that keep the whole company from being agile, right? So you can have a great delivery team that's still, you know, only a little tiny piece of a much longer chain, and those other parts of the chain are the problem at this point, right?
It would seem that there's just benefits within HR to actually move to that cross-functional team. And we should probably point out that cross-functional team doesn't mean you have a team of everybody that can do everything. It means you have people with those wonderful T-shaped skills. It's not necessarily a team of cross-functional individuals. It's a people with the individuals to meet the spec that you have to deliver, and HR is certainly part of that.
Yeah. Well, actually, I'll throw out a quick thought there. The way I see it really is that you're going for smooth flow in the team, right? And that is that when you have people with very different skill sets and they kind of don't understand one another's jobs, you end up with these big batch sort of rigid handoffs where I have to, you know, really lock things down and to describe them in great detail, because once I give my piece to you, you know, we're not really going to talk anymore, and you need to be able to take my big document or whatever and run with it. But anytime you have situations like that, you tend to have big time gaps between those handoffs, right, or within the handoffs. And you also tend to have a lot of just misalignment, right? That's where problems crop up, and you know, you can't really deal with problems as quickly and so on. So I think having HR people model the agile processes, they'll see that same thing within their own functions. And it's maybe less a matter of me learning all the details of how to do your job, and it's just more a matter of me figuring out how to make that handoff a lot smoother, right? We can have a lot more overlapping roles, if you will.
Yeah. The other half of this, of course, is you were mentioning that there are different facets. Like, you might choose to use Kanban for something. You might choose to use Scrum for other things. And I'm guessing it really depends on the nature of the work. I could see with Scrum, things that would jump to mind would be change initiatives, projects, things that might be we need to start up a new team. That I could see as an iterative approach could work really well.
Yeah.
Whereas Kanban, sort of that more flowy side of things, it might be we've got a specific role to fill. That's a pull-based system. You do it as demand, isn't it?
Yeah.
Where do you see how that works? I've even heard of having a Kanban lane with a Scrum run underneath. What's the mixes that you're seeing out there?
Well, just as you say, actually, my own company, in fact, uses Kanban for recruiting, right? So we've got a pipeline, and we track it on in LeanKit, and you know, use that as a way to track candidates as they come in. It's automated. You know, people apply, it automatically pops onto the board. So you know, that's nice. And our own team uses that, and it's all transparent, so everybody can see it and get in and comment on people and so on. But you know, I think Scrum in general, in my mind, is best suited to building something, right? Building something new rather than running an ongoing process. So I think anything, you know, as you imply, if they're building a new, say, performance management system, right? You're redesigning it. I would see that perhaps as more suitable for a Scrum environment. Truthfully, I very frequently mash those two up, both, you know, for HR functions and actually for just about any team that we work with these days. I find a lot of utility in the detailed metrics and the kind of, you know, fairly evolved visual management tactics behind Kanban. I quite like it. So I think it's nice for people to understand that, understand ideas like pull systems with service classes and so on, because I think they can be useful regardless, frankly, in a Scrum environment if you do actually grasp the mechanics and you can employ them properly.
Cool. We mentioned the M word, metrics. Now, metrics are often feared by teams.
Yes.
What metrics does HR actually get interested in, or what should they be interested in?
Unquestionably, the one that I hear the most is some variation on happiness, right? Happiness, engagement, you'll hear it termed various ways. But historically, you know, you've had retention as sort of the buzzword, and that's still important, but it's not sufficient, right? And I think the nice thing about the whole happiness deal is just how indicative it is of other things, right? How good it is at pointing out likely or pending problems in other areas. You know, the problem, frankly, with most metrics is they're kind of useless, right? You look at them and you're like, this number goes up, it goes down. What does it mean? Well, the fact is there are, you know, 10,000 factors behind it and all these proxy variables, and God only knows. So, you know, with happiness, you can be pretty sure that if your happiness and engagement scores are very high, you know, probably things are not so bad and they're going reasonably well in other areas. And the converse is almost certainly true as well, that if they're tanking, either something bad has already happened or it's coming, right? And again, I think that's what's beautiful about it. It's a leading indicator. whereas a lot of the other metrics that people tend to employ are really lagging indicators, if they're indicators at all.
Again, looking at the HR team, we've got Agile sitting happily working in development space. We're now branching out into business agility. Is HR a good place to start, or where would you suggest starting, actually moving from software to people?
I think HR is an excellent place to start, right? It's sort of a function that's changing so radically and in such an interesting way. The whole idea of kind of spreading culture is so important. And you hear time and again that it is the leading cause of Agile adoptions failing, right? You get one in there. And I've seen many cases at this point in my career of companies starting this stuff and it either dying out or being watered down to the point of uselessness. So I think, if you have an HR group that just intrinsically understands what we're going for here, and I think back actually to a presentation I saw recently, Jonathan Smith, from Barclays was doing a presentation, Jonathan Smart, at the Business Agility Conference in New York a couple months back. And it was mentioning they just use four metrics at the higher level. They use flow, quality, value, and happiness, right? And I thought that was really interesting. I quite like that set of metrics there, and as a matter of fact. And if you put that out there and say, this is the way we actually measure performance, you're aligning the goals of the organization writ large with Agile values and principles and philosophies here. You're saying it's really important that we know what's valuable to people. It's important that our people are engaged. They'll do better work that way, right? As opposed to looking at a lot of these, inherently relatively valueless metrics that a lot of the companies look at. Things like ROI and so on are not fundamentally useful to help your business grow more resilient and less fragile over time. But things like flow, right? How fast can we get things out the door? I thought that was brilliant in particular. Really, aligns well with my lean background and that idea that we're going for speed across the board, not just, say, within a given team. I think things like that, you can model it at the highest levels, and then, lower level behaviors will tend to follow.
People do in excess what the leaders do in moderation.
Yeah, you got it.
I want to be respectful of your time, and I really thank you for the conversation. At the end of our podcast, we give our guests a chance to plug anything they've got coming out. This will be coming out around the middle of June. So what do you have happening?
Yeah, so just on this particular subject, I will say that we're starting to launch a series of Agile HR workshops. So these are not kind of out of the box cookie cutter type things. They're really more custom affairs to help teams really craft an approach that works for them. Because I think, the one thing I should have said at the beginning of this maybe is I don't believe anybody's got this thing figured out entirely. All the things I'm mentioning have been done differently in different ways. So it's really not a one size fits all. You've got to actually craft things in a way that makes sense for your company. We also have a program called the Agile Leadership Academy, which is the next one's kicking off September 10th and 11th out in Herndon, Virginia in our offices. And that's a program for executives. We've had a lot of HR executives come through that program from different companies and have actually engendered some pretty impressive transformations over the course of it. So that's a year-long quarterly program, kind of an ongoing thing to help people transform. So I'd call out both of those as perhaps nice places if people want to get started with it.
Cool. And how can people best reach you?
You can find me either through lifespeed.com. Again, that's LitheSpeed.com. I am A. Bankston on Twitter. And you can also reach me through AgileLeadershipAcademy.com.
Well, thank you again. And to our listening audience, if you enjoyed this episode, please give us a review or ratings or leave comments on iTunes. It really does help us out. Stitcher or your favorite podcasting platform of choice. It does help people find us. If this is your first time tuning in, why don't you subscribe? And if you'd like to join the conversation and share your stories around Agile, HR, PeopleOps, why don't you join us on coalition.agileuprising.com? And finally, support from listeners like you help us cover the cost of our hosting and production. See the show notes for details on how you can become a Patreon. Until next time, this is Agile Uprising Podcast, signing out.